What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Ow! Those uncomfortable things we do for beauty.
Oof. Ouch.
And when it comes to whiter teeth, same story. Until now. Enjoy Wince-Free Whitening with new Sensodyne Clinical White. You'll get clinically proven whitening technology in an enamel-safe formula for 2 shades whiter teeth and 24/7 sensitivity protection. Sensodyne Clinical White, a whiter smile without the wince.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Private equity is a fancy name for a simple operation. Big deal makers round up billions, buy companies, strip them down, add debt, and resell. Done right, it can add efficiency to the U.S. economy. Done wrong or right, it can and often does put billions in the pockets of the dealmakers. On Friday, one of the biggest, the Blackstone Group, went public at a $38 billion valuation. Its bigwigs' tax rate, 15%, like that of the poorest Americans. Now even some big investor voices worry that private equity is on a bad track for the whole country. Up next on Point, inside the Billionaires Club of Private Equity. We'll talk in a moment with one of the great pioneers of the venture capital wing of private equity, Peter Brook, who is now asking tough questions about the new masters of the universe. But first, joining me from New York for the latest on private equity and Wall Street is Robin Farzad from Businessweek magazine. Robin, thanks very much for being here today.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Great. Friday, a huge day for private equity on Wall Street. The Blackstone Group took its company public, sold shares to the public. Why was this such a big deal, and how did it turn out, remind us?
Well, it was a solid deal considering the shares were up 15% on a day where the stock market tanked almost 190 points. It was a really telling contrast that this is a different world. The real meat of the private equity boom has been the past 5 years, where the U.S. stock market has been underwhelming compared to historical returns. And
right.
It shows you that private equity has really picked up the slack where the public markets have left off.
So for big-time investors, this has been where the action is in the Blackstone Group, and its head, Stephen Schwarzman, has been right at the heart of that. Why has this particular company been such a lightning rod for attention and for financial success?
Well, one is a function of their success. They've been great. A lot of their funds have averaged 30% returns after costs. Think about the meteoric rise. He and his partner, Pete Peterson, started this firm with about a couple $100,000 of capital 20 years ago, and now it has $88 billion under management. That's just a meteoric rise. But on the flip side of that, the guy lives a really conspicuous life, Schwarzman. He is a conspicuous consumer. He had a really public birthday party a couple of months ago and wanted the press there. He seems to like his name in the limelight. This is something that other people in the community kind of cringe at. You know, why the heck are you putting yourself out there to kind of vilify us? So he presents himself as a vilifiable figure. I don't even know if that's a word.
and to get others vilified because his fortune has become so very, very large on the back of the work he does. Maybe a $7 or $8 billion stake now in the Blackstone Group, his personal fortune, hundreds and hundreds of millions in compensation last year and more off of this deal. But what kind of deals has the Blackstone Group done, Robin? For people who don't follow this every day, describe some of the kind of deals that they do and the outcome.
Well, let's go through the name here. They, what Blackstone does is they step up to the plate and take advantage of an arbitrage in the market. Debt, as you know, has been very cheap for the past 4 or 5 years. As people who've
very low interest rates,
low interest rates to buy, taking out big mortgages to buy big houses at low rates. And similarly, they've been taking advantage of 5-6% interest rates to go in and lever up balance sheets and take out the public shares of companies such as Equity Office Properties, which is the biggest corporate landlord in the
United
States.
Sam Zell's company, yep.
Sam Zell's company. And they bought that at what many think is the top of the real estate market, so they must have some levers to pull. They bought Alliance Data in May for $8 billion, extended stay hotels. They've bought and sold.
So they'll take a little bit of their own money and money of investors, more of that, and then a whole lot of low interest rate debt. buy an enormous company that's public or even private, what, tinker with it, supposedly make it more efficient, and then resell it at what they hope is a giant profit.
You got that. And there's something ostensibly in their special sauce. I mean, something that you and I as an investor sees one of these moribund shares languishing on the market. We can't see value in that. And yet they take certain things, such as this big landlord, and they split up properties and they rationalize it, and they have this kitchen cabinet of expert managers across all industries. And they really put that to use and make magic where you would least expect it.
Now, very often part of the package is they cut spending at these companies that they take over, cut workers, offices, factories, advertising, maybe even R&D, add a whole lot of debt. Whether it works out great or not, though, part of the criticism has been that the private equity groups make out like bandits, even if it's not a tremendous success on the business side.
That is right. But, you know, remember we had this debate 20 years ago in the heyday of Milken and Boesky, and people like Nelson Peltz, who's back in the news again. They called this the junk bond empire and the den of thieves in the late 80s and the LBO business. You don't hear about it as the LBO business anymore. They put a more rarefied name on it, but they're doing the exact same thing. But in their defense, they say that they expedite, you know, they're the change agents of the market. If these assets sit around and don't do anything for a long time, inevitably activist investors come aboard, make quote-unquote overtures to management, and they end up in the arms of people like Blackstone and KKR. So they're only doing, they're only expediting what time and the public markets would end up doing anyway. Layoffs would be inevitable. If another company were to buy these companies, invariably they would rationalize and streamline. So in their defense, they say that we are putting the process into light speed.
And this is the characterization of private equity as the great bringer of efficiency to the U.S. economy. But whether that happens or not lately, they're making an awful lot of cash taxed at what looks to most Americans like a low rate, 15%. It gets the kind of capital gains tax treatment. There's a lot of pushback on that right now in Congress.
Right. This is 15%. I mean, they say we should be incented for taking risks because we take these risks and help these companies. And there are, you know, Congress doesn't come to our aid when we have terrible years and take losses at the front end of these investments. But opponents are saying that's not fair. That's your bread and butter. Why should you get taxed less than a cleaning lady or, you know, an auto mechanic? 15% is an unnaturally low rate.
Particularly when a lot of the money involved here is not their own. It's other investors or straight-up debt, borrowing.
Right. And there's been a really surprising backlash to this in Congress in the past month or two. This is really esoteric stuff where it's hard to explain this to constituents, but especially Schwartz Middle, such a conspicuous life that he's
helps.
Almost presenting himself as a target.
The other fear here is that private equity, with its way out there deals doing so much of the buyout business in the country now, may ratchet up risk for everyone between hedge funds and private equity guys and all the rest, take us out on a limb where everybody ends up in a bust suffering.
Well, I mean, that's an argument, but it's good to look at the numbers. If we look at private equity buyouts as a volume of total mergers and acquisition, whereas in the late 90s it was about 3%, it's closer to 15% now. We see these numbers ratchet up enormously because, as I said before, the stock market has kind of been moribund. These strategic acquisitions, whereas in the past you'd see an AOL buy a Time Warner, a lot of these things fell on their face, and so the assets were just left on the public markets to languish over time. And invariably, these are the people who can show up and have the creditworthiness to take out loans and then run that ledger domain.
Of course, you call it moribund, but that's where most Americans have their retirement savings. I mean, it's not good enough for the super rich, but it's what everybody else is, or an awful lot of people are depending on.
You know, but they have helped a lot of other people. There's something in the market right now called the private equity put, whereas 6-7 years ago, we had the Alan Greenspan put that if a put is like a safety net on the price of a security. If all things go wrong, Alan Greenspan is bound to show up, cut rates, and bail us out of this. Now it's private equity. If a stock price falls too much, invariably these guys hover around and they find a way to take it out at some sort of respectable premium. So that has really put a floor on the market in the past 2 or 3 years.
So we've got an upside and a downside here and a move to come in with higher taxes on these extraordinary hundreds of millions and billion dollars in take-home that this industry is working with. Robin Farzad, you're a terrific explainer, and we thank you very much for your time today. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks for having me, Tom. Appreciate it.
Robert Farzad with Business Week on Wall Street there in New York City. Joining me right now, we're talking, I should say, this hour about the private equity boom and the stamp it's putting on American investment and the U.S. economy. Joining me now from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Peter Brook, one of the great pioneers of private equity and now one of its elder statesmen. In the 60s and 70s, he built TA Associates into what was then the country's largest venture capital firm. He is chairman of Advent International, which he founded in 1984, and which was the country's first global private equity firm. He's invested in the birth and growth of many important U.S. companies, for example, FedEx. He told the Boston Globe recently that the gilded billionaire face private equity shows today has become a sad affair. Peter Brook, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Tom.
You've been in this world of private equity for a long time. You've seen lots of trends come and go. You've recently expressed unhappiness at the way this very big money is working in the economy, or at least the face of it today. What's the problem?
Well, it's the face of it, as you say. I think private equity as a whole has done very good things for the U.S. economy. It's made the acquired companies considerably more effective, more competitive on a global basis. So I think, at large, the industry has done a good job. I think the question one has to focus on here is the acquirer, is the private equity manager adding value to the investment that he the company that he acquires. If he's applying a leverage and doing some financial engineering, that's not necessarily adding to the value. How a private equity manager should be valued is what he does to improve the asset he acquires. Now, if he buys a company at the right price, if he improves it by helping it expand internationally or giving it strategic advice, and over a period of years really adds to the earnings of the company, and then sells it on, gets rid of the non-performing assets, and then sells it on at a profit, he's done a very effective job at creating value. I think one should look at whether the manager adds value, not what the manager takes out of the business. I think it's easy for people to focus on, gee, this fellow made an awful lot of money. Well, If he's created a lot of value, made a lot of money for the investors, increased employment in the company, then he's entitled to
take a
handsome reward.
Peter Brook, our reporter Robin Farzad at Businessweek pointed to Stephen Schwarzman at the Blackstone Group as somebody who's kind of given the business a public reputation problems here, and you seem to agree.
Well, I do agree. I think it's unfortunate. As I said before, I think the vast majority of private equity managers do a very effective job in improving the assets they buy. It seems that the press has hopped on the transgressors who have not added value. They've added debt to their companies, which is a dangerous thing. Over leveraging their companies, which is a dangerous thing, and they have gotten the publicity, and I think have given the industry a black eye. This disturbs me so much is this conspicuous consumption of someone like Schwarzman. It gives a lot of us who've been in the industry a long time and have worked hard to form companies, to build employment, and to create value. It sad that saddens me, and I think that all of those who entered the industry in the first instance entered it with the idea of adding a good, doing good as well as making money. And I'm afraid the making money has gotten more publicity recently than doing good.
You talked with Steve Bailey at the Boston Globe. He characterizes Stephen Schwarzman as the kind of new greed is good Gordon Gekko figure of this era. And, of course, the Wall Street Journal story that we spoke about quotes him saying that his job is to inflict pain, to kill off his rivals, quotes his mom saying, "You don't understand what drives him. Money is the measuring stick." He says he's worth every penny. That's a lot of pennies. Is the take too big? Said it's okay if they add value, but we're looking at hundreds of millions, billions of dollars here. Is this a distortion of our economy?
No, I don't think. I think you have to think of the value somebody creates. If somebody increases the value of a company, by that I mean added to employment, adding new products, adding new markets, and succeeds, that person deserves to be rewarded for that. Now, the question is how much? And
how much value and how much reward?
Well, how much should they be rewarded?
Mm-hmm.
The industry standards are: if you're running a fund, you get your paid, say, 2% of the capital committed to the fund, plus you get a 20% override on the capital
on what
gains.
You make. Yeah.
On what you make. You got to remember the investor gets 80%, and the investor in many instances is our pension funds, college endowments, people who need that investment
sure.
return to carry out their mission. So in effect, the industry has done a good deal of good. You can't lose sight of the fact of how many hundreds of thousands and millions of jobs have created by, you know, venture capital. You mentioned one company early in
Federal
in
Express
my career,
that you were
Federal
involved
Express,
with. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Federal Express, and then you think of Intel. Think of Google. My goodness, these companies have added a tremendous amount, and they've added it because smart people have taken very big risks.
And I think nobody complained about it, really, when those kind of great investments were made and we saw the efficiencies that resulted from them. But there is a feeling in the air. We talked with Tom Wolfe recently. He's no economist, but he follows our culture pretty well. He said, you know, with the Blackstone Group public IPO last week, this is the end of capitalism as we know it, the sense that it's gotten kind of scooped up into a small number of very highly compensated hands who may or may not be doing great work, but who are sure making billions.
Well, that's the sad thing. And, you know, there's no way to determine. I've looked at the statistics of who has added value to the assets they acquired, who has diminished value.
Mm-hmm.
We know that a lot of the private equity people have overleveraged their acquisitions, and overleveraging
that is left them with too much debt.
Too much debt.
Yeah.
Now, you know, interest rates rise, the economy has a slip. The companies are going to be in question that have contracted all this debt,
right?
And the banks that have supplied the debt are going to have some liquidity problems. So we have to be worried about this.
And if that happens, we all pay. Peter Brook, we want to hear much more from you, but I've got another guest who I've just got for a couple of minutes here. If you'd be kind enough to stand by for just a moment.
Certainly.
I want to turn to Washington and Stephen Lerner. He's director of the Service Employees International Union's Private Equity Project, studies the impact of private equity buyouts. He spent 25 years as a union organizer. He's got a labor perspective on this, but hey, we hear from the big money men. Let's hear from labor on it. Stephen Lerner, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
We're well. Here's private equity. It's being celebrated in many quarters. It's being showered with billions in, you know, take home. How do you see the big impact of this? What works for efficiency and what are you worried about, Stephen Lerner?
Well, what we're worried about is that in this country we have the greatest disparity in wealth in recent history. And at the same time that the private equity buyout guys are taking home billions, 50 million workers don't have health insurance, people are getting squeezed out of the middle class, people are losing their pensions, and there's something wrong when a handful of guys can buy up whole pieces of the economy and there's less and less opportunity for most American workers.
What if they're making it more efficient when they buy it up?
Well, the funny thing about it is because private equity is private, you have to depend on their statistics and whether they are or aren't making it efficient. What we are finding is when you look at private equity deals, and if you look at our report in behindthebuyouts.org, there's lots of deals that go bad. There's some deals that work out well. But the bigger story, the bigger context, is that even if they're making some companies more efficient, most workers aren't benefiting. And that's really the challenge for this country.
And what about the tax rate? Of course, it's 15%. That comes from the capital gains model. But there's been a lot of scrutiny of that lately, Stephen Lerner, when, you know, many people who may be in your union, I don't know, or in other unions taking out the trash are paying that same rate. And most Americans are paying much more.
It's almost like Washington, D.C. woke up this week and realized there's been this transformation in the economy and that whole sections of the economy being bought up by a couple different companies and people. And that's exactly right. The person cleaning the building may pay a higher tax rate or the same tax rate as the person that owns it. One of the great ironies is that Goldman Sachs pays dramatically more tax than a private equity firm does. So there's two parts of the problem here. One is these folks are making an enormous amount of money. Second, it's not trickling down, and no way is it getting to the people that are actually doing the work, and I would argue really making the value because they're operating these companies. And third, they're not paying tax at the same rate that their competitors pay. Mm. The other thing that I just think is really important, there's now 5 million workers in this country that work for companies owned by private equity. And they could make a decision to really do something good, which is they could say, we're getting rich, And we think all our workers ought to have health insurance, or our workers should have pension plans. They have the power to have incredible influence to do what Peter Brook said, which is to do good in this economy.
Peter Brook, is there room for a conversation here at this moment in our economic history between a big private equity guy like you and a union guy like Stephen Lerner? Or is it just a chasm?
No. I think we do talk. I'm now referring to my experience. When we have restructured a company throughout the world, take Germany, for instance, we have done this in cooperation with the unions. We've had a dialogue with them and designed a plan that over a period of time, we might have to reduce employment, but if we are successful in carrying out our projected plan, we will add employment over a period of time.
But unions in Germany are a much stronger beast than unions in America today, which are pretty much on their backs.
But even then, this is a dialogue that's led to the right kind of changes that have to be made to sustain a company, and then the right changes that need to be made to add it volume to it and employment to it at a later date. These are very constructive. We don't have to be adversaries in trying to make our economy more efficient. We can work together to ensure that they do become more efficient. I'm a great believer in both the public and private sector a partnership, and I believe in this dialogue with labor to be able to, if something needs changing, if we sit down and talk about the changes that are required, then make them, and then over a period of time, build the companies back up. We've done a good job for our labor, and we've done a good job for our investors.
Stephen Lerner, what would it take, given where we are today, into your mind, your way of thinking, for that balance of efficiency and care for workers within those companies to be struck?
You know, it's interesting because private equity takes different forms. There's one which is venture capital, which is where you help create a company. Mm-hmm. Then there's the buying of distressed companies, which you have in the auto industry. But a huge amount of the private equity buyouts are in the service economy where they're not distressed companies at all, where they're loading up on debt. So the starting point that somehow the company's inefficient versus you engineer financially to leverage it up and then get out quickly is not necessarily accurate. We would love to talk to the private equity industry about three things. We'd like to say, one, what is the role they're going to play in helping the 5 million people that work from have health insurance? Second, since they keep claiming that their investments are fueling pension funds, only 20% of American workers in the private sector have pension funds.
Yep.
They should step up and start creating pension funds for their own workers instead of eliminating them. And third, for workers to negotiate with the companies, they have to agree to recognize the union when workers sign up and say they want a union. So if they want to have a dialogue, then they have to accept workers' right to have a union and say they have a moral responsibility to this country. And the final thing I'd say on it, we keep hearing this word value. Do they create value?
Mm-hmm.
The question here is, what are the values of our country? And these guys have done so well. Is it time they step up to the plate and say, we're going to help workers, we're going to care about people who can't send their kids to college, who can't buy a home? That's what the American dream is about. And for the first time in recent history, the majority of Americans think things will be worse for their children than it is for them.
Stephen Lerner at the Service Employees International Union's Private Equity Project in Washington, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Peter Brook, what are you thinking when you hear that? Do we have a problem? I mean, you've pointed at the conspicuous consumption in the sort of billionaire's row end of things here. Could that be related to the sort of wealth gap we've seen open up so very wide and the problems Stephen's talking about? On the one hand, you've got $40 stone, you know, crab claws, $3,000 Stephen Schwartzman spends on a weekend's food. At the other end, you've got millions without health care, without pension funds, and Stephen says, you know, without union representation. Are these related? Is there a values problem?
Well, you know, I think you're talking about the system itself. I think you're moving off the subject of private equity and venture capital.
But that's where the cutting edge is right now, isn't it? They're doing a lot of these buyouts. They're bringing in the leverage you're talking about.
I think what you've got to do, and I think Congress would be well advised to do this, is not to rush to judgment on what ought to happen with tax rate or anything else, but they should study what venture capital and private equity has done, on one hand, to create more jobs from startup companies, to make companies more efficient. If they study this for a while to determine, in effect, You know, what has the industry contributed to growth and employment? And then after they come up with the results of that study, then decide what corrective action should be taken. That is a much better way to approach this problem than rushing to judgment about the fact that some people have made too much money. I'm worried about the gap between those who have made money and those who haven't. I've never necessarily, been carried away with making money, but it does worry me. But I don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater in this case. I think this system has been a good system in creating wealth, and I don't want to see it altered unless the problem is studied in depth.
Mark is on the line from Boston. Mark, you're on the air with Peter Brook.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm a psychiatric nurse who's happened to read Joseph Schumpeter, who was the big supporter and apologist, for the
creative destruction. And let's make some real value here. Let's change and make capitalists millions.
Capitalism is creative destruction, and your guests and everybody's talked about the creative part of capitalism, which I agree with. No one's talking about the destructive part, and that's what I see every day in my work.
As a psychiatric nurse, how, yes. Mark?
Through both the mental illness, the substance abuse, the effect on families that are caused by dislocation, unemployment, inconsistency, lack of health services.
But has that always been with us? I mean, are you really looking at these latest deals and the new turns and seeing worse?
I think that that's always been with us, but the interesting thing is at a time when our country's been so wealthy that, in fact, we see a lot of these things, at least from my perspective, is increasing among certain groups.
Yeah.
And the question is that nobody wants to talk about the costs of this creativeness, of this value creation. Nobody wants to pay for it. They want the taxes cut. The government, particularly the current governments and past ones, don't want to have it take responsibility for the costs of it. I think the important thing to recognize is the tremendous human costs on this so-called increase in value that nobody seems to want, or very few people seem to want to address.
Yeah, Mark, we hear that loud and clear, and we thank you for calling. Let's get one more call. Kevin in Boston. Kevin, you're on the air.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Great show, by the way.
Thank you.
Both very interesting point of views and perspectives. My initial thought was that I was thinking about giving more tax or suggesting more tax to these big leveraged buyout companies.
Yeah.
However, to me, that's just like another payoff, and it'll just keep going on and on. You're one of your people that brought up a good point about Google and FedEx. However, last statistic I knew, the super wealthy controlled 3% control like 97 or 4% control 96% of the wealth, somewhere in there. It might be off by a percentage. To me, that's no different than the Soviet Union that we used to always cry about.
But if they drive it right, if they drive it to efficiency and economic growth, is it okay then?
Well, I mean, I'm a working-class white male, and I feel since I've been a child in this country since the 70s, I virtually watched the working-class white people have been wiped out from this, a lot of it. And I work in a union job, and we get a pretty good pay scale. However, the work's not consistent. People are working two and three jobs to try and keep their head above water and stay out of debt as well.
Yeah. We've been joined today, and very happy to be, by Peter Brook. He's one of the great pioneers of the private equity industry through venture capital. Many successes behind him. Important, valuable companies built by his work. He joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire today. We're also joined, Hanover's big today, we're also joined right now from Hanover by Colin Bladen. He's director of the Center for Private Equity and Entrepreneurship at the Tuck School of Business, where he is Dean Emeritus. Colin Bladen, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you and your guest, Tom.
So you see both the big money we're talking about, the leverage and debt that comes with a lot of these deals, the concern even in the corner of someone as steeped in this business as Peter Brook over the infatuation with gigantic wealth here, perhaps even more than bringing value. How are you looking at what's going on? Is private equity working as it should for this whole country, not just a few?
Well, one thing you've got to realize is that the rules of the game didn't suddenly change. The rules that these guys have been playing by are the rules that have been in place since the beginning of this industry. The structure of the way the gains are shared between investors and the people who manage the investment. What's new is that in the last 2 to 3 years, it's been a perfect storm of value creation. Capital markets, debt, has gotten more available, it's gotten cheaper,
Interest rates low, Wall Street share prices kind of lagging, so there's a great opportunity for private equity to come in, scoop companies up.
Yes, and also the cash flows of these companies have generally been improving. So these guys are sitting at the eye of a perfect storm, and what has happened is that they have generated great wealth, and yet how they do it, these guys have been private, how they do it is not very well understood. So you've got sudden awareness of this great wealth on the one hand and a lack of understanding of how they've done it.
Well, you say lack of understanding, Professor, but I'm reading here Andy Kessler, former hedge fund manager right in the middle of this business. He understands it pretty well. He looks at it and says, the dirty little secret is that private equity investors really aren't all that good. He's looking at this perfect storm you're describing. It's been so easy. They're making a lot of money, but not necessarily adding tremendous value.
Well, there are three ways to add value, and your guests have certainly pointed those out. One is you can buy smart. You can buy low and sell high. Blackstone's investment in Celanese recently is probably a good example of that. The other one that your guest, Peter Brook, has been talking about is they are more willing to be aggressive about putting debt on it. And then the third one is they actually have to improve the cash flows of the company, make the companies fundamentally themselves more valuable. They have to do all three of those things in this very competitive age, because if they sell a company, they need to sell it at a higher value than they bought it at. So,
right, but they don't have to sell it for that much more these days. And in the and it's not that hard when your cost of the borrowing is so low. And whatever they sell it for, they come in with very often hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in fees. And people look on and say, you know, is the system just being played in this particular point in history?
No, but the fact of the matter is that for their shareholders, public companies can do the same things that the private these private buyers do. And in fact, the value of the potential of being able to do that is reflected in many of the stock prices today. And these guys also buy these companies at a premium over their public price. So the shareholders do get some of it. So I think some of what we're seeing, the kind of backlash that we're seeing about the tremendous value that these guys are taking home for themselves, but also for the public employee pension funds who are putting up the capital and taking 80% of the capital gains.
That's a piece of it. If you've got a pension fund, that's great. And Stephen Schwartzman says in the Wall Street Journal that he's not a marauding, low-class, low-brow inflictor of random damage. Not him. We want to hear more from you, great sages, but our callers are pushing in here, too. Let me go to Dana in Brewster, Massachusetts. Dana, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, I keep hearing a lot of talk about generating wealth, creating value, but, you know, one thing I don't hear asked, and I really wish I would hear this more on public radio, is for whom is this wealth generated? And, you know, like, cui bono, who benefits? And, you know, there is a big disparity here, which I don't feel has been properly addressed. I mean, so, like, for whom is this value created?
Dana, hold the thought. Peter Brook, what do you say to our caller, Dana?
Well, the value has been created for those who own the stock in the company. And if those owners happen to be a pension fund or a college endowment and so forth, they're the ones that have a benefit from their ownership in that company that has succeeded and has been moved forward and sold at a gain.
But what about Dana's point then? You know how concentrated share ownership is in this country. Is it widely enough distributed, the value that's created here, to justify the giant take-home on the other side?
I think you have to ask how many pensioners are there in a pension fund?
How many people are there in America? There's a lot fewer pensioners than citizens in this country, and increasingly fewer by ratio.
But you see, that's another question that you have to answer. This has nothing to do with private equity and venture capital. The question is, should companies be forced to take care, and this is a good question, of their employees' long-term benefits of their employees? Of course they should, but that's another question, and I don't think we should mix up the two.
Well,
I think there's a much more, and I think the professor at the Tuck School had it right when he said that the bigger question here is, will this massive transfer of assets from public to private hands lead to better management, lead to better increased competitiveness,
right.
and employment? Or will it lead
sure.
to the opposite?
It's
That's the question.
It's a great question, but you know, you're quoted saying, as I read you, Peter Brook, that you're worried about exactly that, that the measuring stick of this kind of work and investment ought to be the contribution that the investors make to the company and therefore to the economy, and you're worried that it is not now, that it's money in their own account.
Well, I've made this comment from the beginning. Mm-hmm. I think that a great many private equity investors do add value and mm-hmm. do things the right way. I think there are transgressors that are highly publicized that do the opposite, that add too much debt, that cut employment, that dispose of assets, that leads to employment losses, and how do you enact a law that will not damage the ones mm-hmm. that are adding value mm-hmm. and take away from those who are decreasing value? And I don't know the answer to that. I think that's something that we have to investigate thoroughly.
Colin Bladen, do you have an answer? How do we, if a law is needed, if legal action is needed to sort of separate the wheat from the chaff here, how would you do it?
Well, the real problem, I couldn't agree with Peter Brook more. You better do it carefully if you're going to do anything.
Sure.
The temptation of trying to look at this great new wealth and saying, boy, we need a slice of it for federal tax coffers, or we need to make sure that they're not making so much money, can be dangerous, because you can aim at Steve Schwarzman and you could hit a fireman or policeman retiree.
But I think Americans understand that. I think when they look out and see wealth creation, we are famously generous in our acceptance of that as a country. It's part of our culture to say good for you, but with the expectation that at some level it's good for everybody else as well. You guys are smart. You've been around a long time. You see the wealth inequality that's grown again, the sort of stagnant wages we've seen for a lot of Americans. Don't you worry about it, Colin Bladen?
I do. And you are pointing to exactly the factor. I mean, what Steve Lerner said is right on point. We have seen tremendous increase in value and in wealth and in the performance of the American economy over the last 5 years. The problem is the benefits of that growth, of that increased wealth, that increased value, has gone to the very top slice of the American economic pyramid. And in the past, when we saw this expansion of wealth, it was shared with everyone. And Americans are incredibly tolerant when they know that they're doing pretty well, too. If the people who are taking the risk are doing extraordinarily well, they're sort of willing to cut them some slack. But if the large bulk of the American worker and workforce know and feel in their gut
mm-hmm.
they are not participating, and they see the top slice doing very well while the economy is doing very well, it's a perfect situation for the kind of reaction that we're seeing today.
Peter Brook, isn't it a kind of cultural crime then to push this country to that point where people feel so kind of disenfranchised from the party of, you know, as you put it, the stone crabs at $40 a claw and fine wines and brass bands for mega wealthy guys' birthday parties? If people feel so cut out of that that we put at risk the very generator that's made this country overall so rich.
Yeah, of course we do. Now that's the problem. It's a problem that there are a few people, and I believe it is a few. I don't believe it's the vast, as I say, proportion of people in the private equity business, but those at the very top that have been publicized for these mega deals, where they've taken so much out for themselves, that's a bothersome thing. It should bother everybody. Now, the question is, we have never been well known in this country for policing ourselves. I think right now the industry has to find a way. It might be too late. I mean, I think mm-hmm. that this rush to legislation, you know, might be there's so much momentum and there's so much push in this that something destructive might happen.
Are you talking about the tax rate change that's up on the rails now from 15% to maybe 35%?
Right. I'm talking about the tax rate change before really just studying the issue of job creation. I think that whole issue needs to be studied before any corrective action is suggested. But what I would like to see would be the industry policing itself. We would love to see people like Schwartzman and Peterson say, look, this is not helpful to the capitalist system. What we're doing now could bring the system down or create certain responses that are inimical. So that's what bothers.
So let's get a grip, boys, here. Let me get a couple more calls. Stevel's calling from Groton, Massachusetts. Stevel, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to back up the conversation slightly. I mean, this is a big set of issues, and as I've been waiting for you to take the call, it's just more and more subtopics and side topics come up.
Let's hear your best, Stevel.
Let me go back to, if I can, the question of efficiency. Some of these hedge funds, their claim to fame, or part of their claim to fame, is that they're increasing efficiency.
That's it, in a nutshell, yeah.
It seems to be kind of a ruse. Where does this extra money come from? Really, the value of a company is the products and services they provide. And if they're not doing it effectively, what does that mean? It means their costs are higher. Well, that means they're paying money to somebody else, but that somebody else is still, for the most part, within the economic system.
Yeah, but you don't want an economy where, let's say, we have, payrolls larded with people doing nothing. If that were happening, surely you'd say, well, let's cut some of that and be more efficient, wouldn't you?
Not necessarily, because now if you go towards efficiency, you cut those people out, now they don't have a job.
Yeah, but if long-term you don't have an efficient economy, you probably don't have a job either. But we take the skepticism. Steve, let us hold that. Let me get another call here from Sumter, South Carolina. Jason, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And hi to your guest, too. I wanted to actually say something about when your guests were saying, well, how do we create a law or a way to penalize people who are abusing the system, who are detracting from value, or destroying it altogether. And the thing is, we do have laws against that. It's basically laws against theft.
But you and I both know that those don't work out too well. Send a cop on the beat over to Stephen Schwartzman's house, and he's not going to arrest him for robbery.
Yeah, definitely. But this is basically, purposely damaging a company. It's misappropriation in so many ways. And, if people were honest enough to police that system, and police themselves, I think we'd see a lot of this really just going to courts.
Well, let's talk about it for a second. We just got a couple of minutes, but Peter Brook, if you could speak to Stephen Schwartzman, for all I know, maybe you do, you have kind of through the press, what would you say to him and his cohort? It's not just him, who are kind of at the riding very high end of this, but not necessarily giving back in a way that keeps the country on board.
Well, the first thing I'd ask him is his mother's comment about how he measures himself correct.
All
by money, because the fact is, it's the contribution. It has to be. He has to find a way to measure his contribution to this country and this contribution to the economy. I don't think he's helping the economy, and I would. That's how I would direct my question.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to leave behind as people's memory of you? How do you want to be remembered? As someone who's added or someone who's made an awful lot of money and taken it home? It's unseemly to me. I don't know. This is why I wrote the article to begin with and what upsets me so much now.
Yep, there's the message from Peter Brook and Colin Bladen. What about it if we go for a tax change here from the 15% rate, which does seem kind of obscene sometimes on these take-homes where there's not that much at risk from these guys. But if it goes to 35, New York Times says today, hey, Blackstone went public even with that threat in the air at a pretty handsome premium. This isn't a problem. They can take it in stride. Do you think so or not?
Well, I think certainly Blackstone believes they can. Otherwise, they would not have moved so aggressively on their IPO, and it would not have been so well received. And I can't help but really endorse what Peter Brook has been saying, that if the Congress is going to change the incentive structures, because that's what taxes are,
sure.
They better do it very carefully. For example, if they tax these funds more highly, Are they going to be less efficient? Do they pass some of those taxes and the impact of them along to their investors? Who are the pension funds, the university endowments? What really is going to be the effect? So that's why I said, if you aim at Steve Schwarzman, you better be careful about who you're going to actually hit with when you pull the trigger.
Yeah, we hear that, but there's a lot of impatience out there for something to happen. At the same time, Colin Bladen, Professor Dean Emeritus at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Peter Brook, really a privilege and a pleasure to have you with us, Peter Brook, chairman at Advent. Thanks a lot for being here.
Well, Tom, it's been my pleasure. Thanks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.